Nathan and Cotton Blossom reached Gallatin an hour before noon. The bank was closed, and Nathan soon discovered the reason. Up one of the shaded streets, Nathan could see a church steeple. And judging by the number of horses and buggies tied up outside, the place was full. On Thursday afternoon, it could scarcely be anything but a funeral. Nathan rode slowly toward the church. It was a poor time to ask questions, but he needed to know in which direction the James gang had ridden after the robbery. The hearse, with its team of matched black horses, waited outside the church. Nathan spoke briefly to the black-garbed undertaker who stood beside the hearse and was advised to wait for the sheriff to come out. He waited across the wide street, well out of the way, until the grim proceeding was over and the pallbearers brought out the coffin. When the hearse rolled away, most of the mourners followed, some mounted, some afoot. Nathan left his horse and walked across the street, approaching a tall, thin man with a star pinned to his cowhide vest.
You're Sheriff Kilmer, I reckon?
I reckon I am. I've already talked to the Pinkertons. You a bounty hunter?
No. This is a personal thing. One of the James gang had a hand in murdering my family. Just to get him, I'll turn the whole bunch in if I can. The reward has nothing to do with it.
There ain't much to tell. I got a posse pronto. We trailed the varmints north to the Des Moines River, and that's where we lost them. Just teetotal lost them.
How many riders?
Three. I know the damn newspapers didn't mention a third man, but we tracked three horses. Trouble is, that's farm country, and there's wagon roads crossing that river at every shallows. All them varmints had to do was keep their horses in the water till they got to the first wagon crossing. There they could have got out, mixing tracks of their horses and with God knows how many others. Pinkertons lost them just like we did.
The papers said one of them lost his horse and that they stole another.
That they did. Took old Dan Smoot's bay, and he's been giving me hell ever since.
What became of the stray horse, the one that belonged to the outlaws?
Why, I don't know. We had three riders to follow, and we all lit out after him, hell for leather. It was dark when we got back to town.
Thanks. It won't bother you if I try my luck?
None whatsoever.
Nathan returned to his horses, mounted up, and leading the pack horse, set out down the street toward the bank. It suited his purpose perfectly that all or most of the town had followed the unfortunate banker's body to the cemetery. There had been no rain, nothing to destroy the sign, and he quickly found where the outlaw had been dragged. It was equally easy to find where he had managed to free himself from the stirrup, and from there, the tracks of the freed horse led west. Most western men, outlaws included, had a favorite horse, and if set loose, that horse would return to the nearest corral it considered home. With that in mind, Nathan set out to trail the horse. He soon discovered part of the caulk on the left rear shoe was missing. With that kind of edge, he could trail the animal over any wagon road, through innumerable other tracks. It all depended on how long the outlaw had owned the horse, how long the James gang had been holed up at some particular place, and whether or not they felt safe in returning to that place following the Gallatin bank robbery. The gang had gone to great lengths to lose the sheriff's posse and the Pinkertons, and that argued favorably toward their return to a favored hideout. Nathan had to ride carefully, for he had no idea where the trail would lead. But with the outlaws riding their horses in the water, they must ride north or south until they struck off along a well-traveled wagon road. If his thinking was running true, this horse he was following must, at one of these wagon crossings, turn east or west. Slowly but surely, the trail he followed veered northeast toward the Des Moines River. When the horse had reached the river, the animal hadn't crossed, but had traveled south. Nathan followed, feeling he was safe until the trail turned east or west along one of the numerous wagon crossings. Nathan estimated they had traveled at least 10 miles to the south, crossing many wagon roads, when the horse he was trailing suddenly veered west. He had indeed taken one of the wagon crossings, and his tracks were mixed with those of many other horses. Nathan was all the more thankful for the broken caulk, for he could follow the trail easily. But when the horse he followed left the wagon road, Nathan must ride with caution, for he had no idea where the outlaw's stronghold might be. He rode for almost an hour, and by the time the trail left the wagon road, sundown was near. He looped the reins of the black and the lead rope of the pack horse over a pine limb. On foot, he continued to the top of a ridge. In the valley below was a farmhouse. A few hundred yards to the east of the house was a barn, and in an adjoining corral, Nathan counted 5 horses. He had heard Frank and Jesse James had friends all over Missouri, otherwise respectable people who harbored the outlaws. If this were the case here, he might have trouble rooting them out. He returned to his horses. When it was dark enough, he would then approach the house, hoping to prove or disprove his suspicions. If there were dogs involved, his reaching the house would be difficult, with or without Cotton Blossom. While he could command the dog to remain with the horses, that left him open to the very real possibility that he might stumble into one or more dogs without warning. But there was another thing to consider. If Cotton Blossom accompanied him and had the misfortune to encounter other dogs, well, nothing drew attention quicker than a stomp-down good dogfight. He was perhaps a mile west of the ridge from which he had observed the farmhouse. Here he must leave his horses. Fearing discovery, he'd been unable to follow the trail any farther in daylight, so he didn't know for certain the isolated farmhouse concealed the outlaws. But all evidence led him to that conclusion. Nathan had heard and read enough about Frank and Jesse James to know that they sometimes escaped a sheriff's posse by using relays of horses. Leaving their tired horses and mounting fresh ones, they could ride 100 miles if necessary. When he judged it was dark enough, Nathan set out for the point where the trail he had been following led across the ridge. In the house far below, there was a tiny pinpoint of light. He started down the ridge toward the light, Cotton Blossom following. He heartily wished he could communicate to the dog a need for caution. But as they progressed, he realized Cotton Blossom had learned certain things, as evidenced by his conduct. When Nathan rode the black horse, Cotton Blossom could trail ahead. But when Nathan was afoot, it meant he didn't wish to be discovered. The dog remained slightly behind Nathan. And but for his shadow in the dim starlight, he might not have existed. Nathan circled far to the east of the house, coming in behind the barn. He would have liked to examine the hooves of the animals in the corral, verifying the broken calk, but that was too risky. Any kind of disturbance among the horses would bring wanted men on the run, their guns blazing. Nathan approached the house from the dark side, working his way around to the lighted window. Fortunately, the house had been built on the side of a slope, and the kitchen end, where the lighted window was, sat virtually on the ground. A lighted lamp sat on a dining room table, and while its glow was feeble, there was enough light to get a man killed should he be fool enough to stand directly before the window. Nathan kept to one side, peering in from the darkness. There were 4 men at the table, while a woman was bringing in food from what was obviously the kitchen. Only one man had his back to the window, and Nathan guessed that man was probably the host. 2 of the men, Frank and Jesse James, sat on the far side of the table facing the window. The 3rd man sat on Jesse's left, at the end of the table, and Nathan studied him. His eyes were cruel, his mouth turned down at the corners in a perpetual frown, and the hat tipped back on his head was that of a Union officer. Nathan had seen enough. He slipped away, thinking about his next move. He might have shot the 3rd man on suspicion alone, but not without exposing himself to murderous fire from both Frank and Jesse James. And had he not killed his man with the 1st shot, there would be no chance for another. Nor had he ever forgotten that day when the cold eyes of Jesse James had bored into him and the outlaw had promised to kill him. What bothered him most was that these outlaws were slick as calf slobber when it came to escaping. 1 failed shot on his part could cost him an opportunity that might never come his way again. This situation called for a posse, enough men to surround the house at dawn. Then he remembered the funeral in Gallatin, the hordes of mourners following the coffin of a man the outlaws had gunned down in the bank. Where else was he likely to find a sheriff and a posse willing and eager to ride out in the small hours of the night on the word of a stranger? Returning to his horses, Nathan rode back to Gallatin. taking note of various landmarks along the way. He found nobody at the small jail, but it was still early, and there were lights in many windows. He had no trouble finding the little house where Sheriff Kilmer lived. He was a small-town lawman, but he was no fool. The light in the house went out.
Who is it, and what do you want?
I spoke to you this afternoon after the funeral, and I want a sheriff and a posse. I found the owl hoots that killed your banker.
Open the door and come in. You're covered.
Nathan stepped into the living room. Light from another room bled in through an open door. Kilmer was fully dressed, except for his boots and hat. Only then did Kilmer ease down the hammer of his Colt and holster the weapon.
Sit and talk.
Nathan did, and Kilmer listened, chuckling with appreciation as Nathan told of trailing the riderless horse to the isolated farmhouse.
By God, that's Sim Hinkle's place. Him and Eberly's been here 40 years and more. How in hell can they shelter outlaws and killers?
There's no accounting for the hombres men choose for their friends. I'm telling you what I saw. You'll have to take my word until you see for yourself. Like I told you, I don't care a damn about any reward or recognition. All I want is a clean shot at Ringo Tull.
I can't promise you that. I'll be in charge of the posse, and there'll be no shooting unless they start it. We'll surround the house, and they'll be ordered to surrender.
Sheriff, you can't drown a man that was born to be hanged. Jesse James will never be taken alive. I understand your position. While I don't aim to try and tell you how to do your job, I'd like to offer you some advice based on hard-won experience. When you organize your posse, be sure every man can and will shoot. I'll follow your rules because I want to ride with you. I believe I've earned that right.
Beyond a doubt. I want you to come with me while I organize the posse. There's a small stable behind the house, room enough for your pack horse. Why don't you leave him there?
Sheriff Kilmer quickly found 10 men eager to take part in the capture of the notorious Frank and Jesse James. Nathan led them to the farm and was satisfied with the manner in which the sheriff deployed his men in the surrounding of the house. He believed, however, that the lawman was underestimating the ruthlessness and resourcefulness of Frank and Jesse James, and his doubts were justified when Sheriff Kilmer issued his challenge. It came an hour before dawn.
You in the house! Frank and Jesse James, this is the law and you're under arrest. Come out with your hands up. We have the house surrounded.
We're coming out, but Sim and Emily are coming with us. They'll see us safe to our horses. And if you cut down on us, they'll die. Now back off.
Nathan slipped away and ran for the barn. He didn't intend for all his work to be for nothing, and this might be his last chance at Ringo Tull. He ducked between the rails of the corral fence and, with his back to the barn wall, concealed himself in the shadows. Nathan doubted the posse would fire at any of the outlaws if they emerged in a group, with the Hinkles before them. Once they reached the corral, however, they must separate to mount their horses. Nathan saw their dim shapes in the starlight. One of the outlaws dropped three rails from the corral, and they moved toward the horses. But the animals were wary of so much activity in the pre-dawn darkness and moved toward the far side of the corral.
Come here, you damn jughead!
Saddles were out of the question, and they were having trouble mounting the skittish horses bareback. Nathan recognized Ringo Tull, for he wore the broad-brimmed hat of a cavalry officer. The other two men were hatless, and it was they who mounted first. They kicked their horses into a gallop, leaving Sim and Emily Hinkle in the corral dust. Tull had managed to mount, but before he could gallop away, Nathan shot between the hooves of the already skittish horse.
Get up, and be careful what you do with your hands.
Tull got to his feet and lifted his hands shoulder high.
In the fall of 1865, 7 no-account varmints murdered my family. You were one of them.
You got the wrong hombre. I've never been to Virginia in my life.
Well, I didn't mention Virginia. You just give me all the proof I need.
Nathan holstered his Colt.
Now, go for your gun.
It was almost Nathan's undoing. Tull's Colt was on his left hip, butt forward, but his right hand didn't move. His left hand came down slowly, and he had the sleeve gun palmed before Nathan drew. The Derringer roared once, hitting the dirt. The Derringer missed, but Nathan shot Tull just above his belt buckle. The sheriff and some of the posse were close enough to have witnessed the shooting.
Damn!
You were close enough to plug Frank or Jesse, and you shot this varmint.
It was this varmint I wanted. I'm leaving Frank and Jesse to you and your amigos.
Nathan decided to remain in Kansas City for a while, mostly because he enjoyed the nearness of the river and the quiet living at Epi Bolivar's boarding house. Cotton Blossom always made friends with whoever did the cooking, and Epi had fallen victim to his charm. It was convenient for Nathan when Cotton Blossom was satisfied to remain behind, for the dog was never at his best in saloons and gambling houses. Nathan continued riding into town 3 days a week, occasionally visiting the saloons, listening to the talk of bullwhackers, roustabouts, bartenders, and gamblers. There were newspapers from Omaha, St. Louis, Memphis, and New Orleans, as well as the local Kansas City Star. It was in the Kansas City paper that he read of the most recent episode in the lives of Frank and Jesse James. Despite their clash with the law, they had holed up at yet another farmhouse in Clay County, not far from Kansas City. Four members of a sheriff's posse had been about to close in on Frank and Jesse as they hid out in a barn on the Samuels farm. Warned by a man who was employed by Samuels, Frank and Jesse had spurred their horses out of the barn when the posse had begun to close in. There had been a wild exchange of gunfire that had killed Deputy Sheriff John Thomason's horse. The notorious James brothers had again escaped. The first week in January 1870, there was a story in the Kansas City newspaper that intrigued Nathan. It concerned trouble along the right-of-way of the Kansas Pacific Railroad between Kansas City and Hayes, some 300 miles west. It was a twofold problem, both of vital concern to the government, and it threatened the very existence of the railroad. Telegraph poles and lines were being pulled down by Indians, the Cheyennes, who hated and feared the talking wire and sought to destroy it. Fort Hayes, a mile south of the town, had become a major government supply point for forts in all of western Kansas and part of Indian Territory. Disruption of telegraph service between Kansas City and Fort Hayes had incensed the military. But that wasn't all. Military payrolls went by rail as far as end of track, tempting outlaws to rob the trains, stopping them by destroying part of the track. The Kansas Pacific was fighting back, offering pay of $100 a month to plainsmen, men who could and would shoot, to ride along the Kansas Pacific track from Kansas City to Hayes and back again. Four such men were to be hired. Nathan went to the Kansas Pacific office and asked for Joel Netherton, the man responsible for hiring. Netherton proved to be a slender young man with glasses who looked like a schoolteacher. He regarded Nathan with interest, his eyes lingering on the twin Colts.
Do you own a repeating rifle?
I do.
Sit down. Can you read and write?
I can.
Do you by any chance know Morse code?
No.
We can teach you that. The railroad decided it would be easier to teach an Indian fighter the code than to teach a telegrapher to shoot Indians.
Well, I'm not too sure about that. That set talks almighty fast.
Well, you must know the code. You'll have a portable set with you. There will be times when you'll have to repair and test a line, and if there's damage to the track, you'll have to warn us so we can delay or stop the next train.
I like the sound of it. When do I start?
8 o'clock in the morning. I'll need you to complete and sign this form before you leave. Place it here on my desk.
He went out, leaving Nathan with a single sheet of paper and a pencil. Nathan grinned. All the Kansas Pacific required of him was his signature. That absolved them of all responsibility in the event he was killed by Indians or outlaws, struck by lightning, run over by a locomotive, if his horse threw him or fell on him, if he shot himself, and the list rambled on. He signed it, leaving it and the pencil on Netherton's desk. He believed he could learn the Morse code and believed it was knowledge he could use to his advantage on the frontier. Nathan spent 3 days laboring over the code, attempting to memorize the combinations of dots and dashes that form different letters of the alphabet. Finally, at the end of the third exhausting day, Netherton felt he was ready for the test. The morning of the fourth day, he was allowed to try his hand at receiving a message. It came slowly, and to his everlasting surprise, he found himself able to take it down on paper. As he mastered the code, the transmissions were speeded up. when he was allowed to send, he quickly became adept, for he knew the code.
Congratulations. You leave for Hayes next Monday.
Nathan had made arrangements to leave his pack horse at Eppie's place, for he would pass through Abilene, as well as several other villages that had sprung up along the Kansas Pacific tracks. If he were chased by Indians or outlaws, a pack horse might hinder him when he should be riding for his life. Worse, the horse and its pack might prove an added temptation to the Cheyennes. He could survive from his saddlebags, taking up the slack when there was town grub to be had. He had no idea what situation might confront him as he rode from Kansas City to Hayes and back again, but the railroad led west, and it might bring him the one remaining killer who had yet to die. Abilene was only 75 miles west of Kansas City, a day's ride for a man on a good horse. For that reason, most of the trouble with Indians and outlaws was taking place between Abilene and Hayes, for the telegraph could relay messages quickly to Kansas City. A locomotive with tender and a freight car could be dispatched within the hour, bringing soldiers or a posse with horses, but only if the telegraph line was intact and there was somebody who knew the code to send the message. Every train crew included at least one qualified telegrapher, but Indians and outlaws had rendered them useless, for they had taken to pulling down or cutting telegraph lines 10 to 15 miles east of where they had torn up the track. That left a train crew with a dead telegraph line back to Kansas City and the soldiers at Fort Hayes more than 200 miles ahead. The outlaws, seeking military payrolls, were a hazard only to westbound trains. The Indians, however, intent on the destruction of the telegraph and the railroad, might strike anywhere along the line. So far, they had concentrated on the lonely stretch of track between Abilene and Hayes. January 10th, 1870. Nathan Stone rode west, following the Kansas Pacific tracks. He knew the train schedule. For the time being, thanks to destruction of the track by Indians and outlaws, trains ran only during daylight hours. A train leaving Kansas City one morning remained at Hayes overnight and returned to Kansas City the next day. Roundhouse facilities were always at end of track. From what Nathan had been told, a second line rider would leave Kansas City on Wednesday, scheduled to reach Hayes on Sunday. Another pair of riders would follow a similar schedule, riding east to Kansas City and following a two-day layover, returning to Hayes. Maybe 150 miles west of Kansas City, Nathan should meet the eastbound line rider from Hayes. By the time Nathan reached Hayes on Friday, a second rider from there should be leaving for Kansas City. While these four outriders couldn't possibly cover the entire line, they would make it more difficult for those who wrought destruction on telegraph lines and Kansas Pacific tracks. Nathan felt he had an edge, Cotton Blossom being with him, and the hound ranged far ahead. He distanced himself from the track, however, when a train bound for end of track rumbled past. There were three flat cars loaded with rails and ties, two box cars, and a caboose. The engineer and fireman waved, for they knew of the outriders hired by the railroad. There'd been some criticism of the railroad for including a baggage car on any train carrying a government payroll, and Nathan could understand what the critics were getting at. Why make it obvious a train carried a government payroll by transporting it in a money coach? Why not just bolt a safe or strong box to the floor of a caboose? Nathan reached Abilene before sundown and took a room at the drover's cottage. By first light, he was riding west, and 2 hours out of Abilene, he found where Indians had sabotaged a section of track. Lacking tools for wrecking the track by dislodging the rails, they had devised a means of having the weight of the locomotive do it for them. Beneath coupling joints, where one rail met the next, they had dug away the ballast, leaving ties and rails suspended over a hole 4 feet deep and a dozen feet long. Not only would the rails buckle under the initial weight of the locomotive, the iron monster would topple from the track and possibly be destroyed. The train had already left Hayes and end of track and would be 2 hours or more into its return journey to Kansas City. Nathan had no tools to repair the roadbed, nor was it his job. It was his duty, however, to warn the crew of the oncoming train about the danger. From his saddlebag, he took a lineman's belt and his portable telegraph key. telegraph poles had spikes for hand and foothold driven in on two sides at alternating levels. Nathan climbed a pole, tied his instrument to the line, and tried a preliminary code. There was no response. Using a similar code, he tried to reach an operator at Hayes, and again, there was no response.
Damn Indians.
Climbing down, he returned the telegraph key and lineman's belt to his saddlebag and rode on westward. Somewhere between where he was and Kansas City, the telegraph line was down, just as it was down ahead of him. While he must eventually repair both brakes, his most urgent duty was to warn the oncoming train, stopping it short of the ruined track. The crew might or might not be able to repair the roadbed to the extent that the train could proceed. Nathan would be forced to backtrack until he found where the telegraph line was down, repair the brake, and report the situation to the Kansas Pacific dispatcher at Kansas City. That done, he must try to make up for lost time as he rode toward Hayes, looking for a second break in the telegraph line. Suddenly, he reined up when he reached a stream that flowed through a culvert under the railroad track. Why was he riding to intercept the train when all the engineer needed was enough distance to brake the locomotive to a stop before it reached the damaged roadbed? Every unnecessary mile he rode toward Hayes would be a mile he must backtrack, seeking the downed line that must be repaired before he could telegraph Kansas City.
Might as well eat, Cotton Blossom. This is as good a place as any to wait for the train.
He shared jerked beef with Cotton Blossom, and they drank cold water from the stream. Nathan checked his pocket watch and found it was almost 2 o'clock. He judged he was at least 100 miles west of Kansas City. The train from Hayes was 6 hours into its journey, and within the hour, there would be some sign of its coming. He got down on his knees, put his ear to a rail, and heard a distant humming. The train was approaching. One thing to be said for the Kansas Plains, if there was anything in the sky for 10 miles, be it circling buzzards or smoke from a locomotive, a man with good eyes had no trouble seeing it. There was virtually no wind, and he soon could see a dirty gray smudge against the unrelenting blue of the western sky. He tied his horse well away from the track, beside the stream. He then took a position on the track. It stretched straight ahead as far as he could see. There was no excuse for the engineer not seeing him. He was able to discern the rising column of smoke long before he could see the train. Growing larger by the second, it came on. Nathan removed his hat, waving it high over his head. Suppose the engineer failed to see him, or just ignored him, thinking he was an outlaw, and the train went thundering on to destruction. But that didn't happen, for outlaws had no reason to rob eastbound trains. Nathan could see the engineer hanging out the big window of the cab. He walked toward the slowing train.
Indians dug out the roadbed 6 miles up the track. Telegraph lines down, east and west.
Well, we'll be waiting here to dark. I'm just thanking God you found the sabotage track. That's hard as hell to see from a moving train. Even if we had seen it, we'd likely couldn't have got this old iron horse stopped before she bucked them rails and rolled over with us. I'm glad you was out here, mister.
So am I. Now I have to ride back toward Abilene and find where they broken the line. I'll telegraph Kansas City for a section crew.
As he walked away to fetch his horse, Nathan saw the brakeman step down from the caboose on his way to learn what had stopped the train. Nathan rode almost to Abilene before finding the broken line. Their method had been simple enough. Roping the top of the pole and dragging it down had snapped the slender wire. Nathan made no effort to raise the pole, leaving that for the section crew. Using pliers the railroad had provided, he managed to twist the broken ends of the wire together after releasing one of them from the glass insulator attached to the fallen pole. He then tied his instrument into the wire and got immediate response from the operator in Kansas City. Following instructions, Nathan sent, as nearly as he could, the location of the downed pole and broken wire, and then the location of the sabotage section of track. When Kansas City had confirmed, he returned the key to his saddlebags and again rode west. When he reached the undermined track, he found that the engineer had brought the train to within a few hundred yards. Nathan paused on his way west and spoke to the engineer and fireman.
Yeah, I patched the broken line and telegraphed Kansas City. They know where you are and why.
Thanks.
Nathan continued west, following the track, and found the second break in the telegraph line some 20 miles distant. He then telegraphed Hayes and again contacted Kansas City to report the location of the second break. The section crew was going to be busy for a while. Come sundown, he unsaddled the black and shared a meager supper with Cotton Blossom. He believed he was at least 125 miles west of Kansas City, and he felt some satisfaction in his accomplishments. He'd saved a train from being derailed, found and repaired two widely separated breaks in the telegraph line, and successfully sent and received messages using Morse code. There was considerable satisfaction in having stepped into this new role and performed successfully. At first light, he again rode west, and an hour later met his counterpart, a rider bound for Kansas City.
Howdy. I'm Nathan Stone, riding for the Kansas Pacific, from Kansas City to Hayes.
Bendon Valentine, nothing's happened at my end. How about yours? Nathan told him of the events of the day before, and they parted company. Nathan reached Hayes on Friday morning, meeting with Otto Donaldson, the Kansas Pacific dispatcher there. Donaldson welcomed him with a grin.
I've been hearing nothing but good about you, Stone. If the other three perform as well as you, there may be hope for the Kansas Pacific yet.
Nathan returned to the boarding house where he'd shared a room with Wild Bill. He had three nights in Hayes before returning to Kansas City, and he paid in advance for a room through Sunday. He and Cotton Blossom found a cafe where they had eaten before and had an early supper. Donaldson, the local dispatcher, had told of Nathan's achievements on behalf of the railroad, and the editor of the local newspaper found him in the cafe.
I'm Emmett Plato. I'm editor of the newspaper here. Donaldson said, look for a two-gun man with a dog. You're Nathan Stone?
I am. Donaldson has a big mouth.
That he does, and I'm glad he does. He's one of the few sources of news. You have no idea how difficult it is publishing a weekly paper in Hayes. If you have the time, will you tell me what it's like being an outrider? A troubleshooter for the railroad?
I'll be here till Monday morning. I seem to have plenty of time.
Nathan related all the details of his ride from Kansas City, including the discovery of the damaged roadbed, stopping the train, repairing the telegraph line, and the sending of messages to Kansas City and Hayes. Plato scribbled it all down, and his gratitude was boundless. He was easy to talk to, and the conversation quickly centered on the boomtown violence that prevailed in Hayes.
When I left here last October, Hickok was county sheriff, and there was some question as to whether his election was legal or not. Was it?
It was not. Governor Harvey in the state of Kansas refused to validate the Ellis County election for sheriff, held last August. A new election was held on November 2nd, and Pete Lanahan beat Wild Bill. He was allowed to remain in office until the first of the year. He certainly wasn't afraid of drunken soldiers and bullwhackers. I'm afraid that can't be said of Lanahan.
Nathan continued to perform his duties with distinction, and when he reached Hayes on Friday, July 15th, he was surprised to find Wild Bill Hickok in town. Nathan and Cotton Blossom were in their usual cafe having supper. Hickok came in, and as though they had parted only hours before, dragged out a chair and sat down across the table from Nathan.
I hear you've become the Kansas Pacific's right-hand man. There was a story on you in the Denver paper.
If you're unemployed, I could put in a word for you with the railroad. Pays $100 a month, and all you have to do is stay alive. They'll teach you Morse code, too.
Yeah, I'd jump at it if it wasn't for that Morse. I never was much good at sums, and I reckon those dots and doodles had hurt my eyes.
Somewhere, in one of the newspapers he was constantly reading, Nathan had seen a report that Wild Bill was losing his sight. At the time, he had doubted the truth of it, but now he wasn't sure. On Sunday morning, Nathan encountered Hickok again as he emerged from the cafe where he'd had breakfast.
Since you're riding out in the morning, let's have us a night on the town tonight.
Thanks, but I reckon not. I am to get an early start in the morning.
Now don't tell me you're still riled over that dust-up over your dog a while back. At least let me buy you a drink and we'll play a hand of poker.
Hickok seemed to have no friends in Hayes, and he wasn't a man to take no for an answer. So Nathan finally agreed to visit a saloon or two for some drinks and a few hands of poker. Drums was one of the more popular places, and that was where they went. The poker didn't bother Nathan nearly as much as Wild Bill's drinking, for he had seen Hickok drunk before. The saloon was full of soldiers from the 7th Cavalry at Fort Hays, and five of them had congregated at a huge round table playing poker. The only civilian was the house dealer. There was just one empty chair, and Hickok took it, his back to the wall. Nathan stood out of the way, content to observe. Cotton Blossom had retreated to a corner, wary of everybody.
Hey, yonder's old Duckbill. The sheriff got thrown out off.
Wild Bill wasn't quite drunk enough, and he kept his calm. However, he had a full bottle of rye whiskey, and Nathan started looking for a break in the game in which he might lure Hickok outside. Any saloon in Hays would be better than this, for the soldiers at the table were already drunk, or nearly so. They'd become careless in their play, and as a result, Hickok was winning consistently. Intentionally or otherwise, the soldier to Bill's right knocked the half-full bottle of whiskey off the table upside down in Hickok's lap. He stood up, the front of his trousers soaked. Hickok seized the whiskey bottle and broke it over the head of the soldier who'd upended it. Bill's chair toppled backward when a soldier lunged across the table at him. Nathan drew a Colt and clubbed a soldier about to smash a chair over Hickok's head, only to have another soldier slug him with the butt of a revolver. Dazed, Nathan fell to his knees, and his assailant hit him again. The soldiers had begun kicking Hickok. Wild Bill drew his revolver. Two soldiers were hit, and the others backed hastily away. Hickok got to his feet, the pistol in his hand. His back already to the wall, he followed it to the door, the revolver cocked and unwavering in his hand. Reaching the saloon door, he backed out. Seconds later, Hickok rode away. Sheriff Lanahan came, accompanied by a doctor, and the two badly wounded soldiers were taken away. Nathan had his badly cut scalp tended to by the doctor. Then, with Cotton Blossom following, he returned to his room at the boarding house and to bed. He rose early with a sore head, and after breakfast went to the Kansas Pacific dispatcher's office to tell Donaldson he was leaving.
Some hell of a brawl at Drums last night.
So I heard. Were those two soldiers hurt bad?
You could say that. Private Kyle's dead. Lansing may not make it. Hickok's really done it this time.
The last week in November 1870, Nathan Stone surprised everybody who knew him. He resigned from the Kansas Pacific. He had friends in Kansas City, Abilene, and Hays, none of whom wanted him to leave. He had found a home if he had wanted it, but he hadn't wanted it. He told himself the unfulfilled promise to his dead father lay heavy on his mind, but he didn't really believe that. In the old South, vengeance had seemed a noble calling. Now it seemed more and more like he was using his vendetta as a crutch, leaning on it, without a life of his own and wanting none. Somehow, somewhere, he must find and kill Dade Withers, the last man on his death list. In a few days, it would be 4 years since he had taken an oath on his father's grave, and he had not a single clue as to the direction he should take in satisfying that oath. He had found Clinton Foster in the wilds of Indian Territory, and from what he had heard and read, it was still a haven for renegades, deserters, and Comancheros. Leading his pack horse, with Cotton Blossom following, he headed there via Wichita. Wichita, Kansas, December 2nd, 1870. The last of the Texas herd had come up the trail until the next spring, and there was little activity in Wichita. Nathan knew it wasn't wise to enter Indian territory without a pack horse. He could carry only a little food in his saddlebags, and certainly none of the utensils necessary for cooking. His wages from the railroad and the $1,200 he had brought with him from Colorado left him with more than $2,000. It was more than enough to cost him his life anywhere on the frontier, living among outlaws. But the man he sought was an outlaw who might remain on the outer reaches of civilization indefinitely. To find that man, the time had come when Nathan Stone must become, or appear to become, an outlaw himself. He bought enough supplies to last 6 months. While he wasn't a drinking man and didn't use tobacco, he took along 4 quarts of whiskey, a supply of plug, and a dozen sacks of Durham. If he survived the outlaws and renegades, he still might have to contend with the Indians. Indian Territory, December 5th, 1870. Nathan followed Chisholm's wagon road for 2 days before riding east, deeper into Indian Territory. He calmed the animal and reined up. It was a warning shot, and he waited for a challenge. It wasn't long in coming.
Who are you and what do you want?
My name is Silver, and I'm looking for a quiet place where I ain't likely to be bothered.
I reckon I know what you mean. Right on the way you're headed. Just don't do anything funny with your hands.
Nathan rode on. He came to a spring, and beyond it, through the pines, he could see the shake roof of a shack. A man emerged from the shack, and he was armed as though he had just fought a war or was about to start one. There was a pistol in a tied-down holster on each hip, and a third such weapon shoved under the waistband of his dark trousers, and a Winchester in the crook of his right arm. A bandolier of Winchester shells was slung over his left shoulder.
That's far enough.
His dress was that of a Mexican, including a high-crowned sombrero. A black vest embroidered in red partially hid a sweat-stained ruffled shirt that had once been white.
I am El Gato, segundo of Cocodrilo Rancho.
I'm Silver. What do you expect of me?
I will ask the questions, senor, and you will answer them. How do you know of this place?
You took a shot at me while I was riding the trail, that's it. Now what do you expect of me?
$100 American for each month you remain here, in advance. For this, you have a place to sleep, and you are under my protection. You will supply your own food.
Well, that's almighty high for a place to sleep, and I don't care a damn for your protection.
Oh, but you should, senor. Without it, you are dead.
It was as slick a shakedown as Nathan had ever seen. He would be forced to remain until they picked him clean. Then he might or might not escape with his life, but he couldn't count on that. For the time being, he must play along. He dug into his pocket, taking a handful of double eagles, counting out 5.
Stay where you are. Breed.
An unshaven man stepped up from behind and took the gold.
You are welcome here, Senor Silver, until you betray my trust. Then I kill you. Breed, you will guide him to the bunkhouse.
Behind El Gato, the door of the cabin opened. A dark-haired girl stood there, barefooted and in rags. She was American and didn't look more than 16, if that. Breed's greedy eyes were on her, and she hurriedly closed the door. Breed turned his attention back to Nathan, pointing northwest with the muzzle of the Winchester. Nathan set out in that direction, leading his horses. Cotton Blossom slunk out of the brush where he had taken refuge, for he had developed an immediate dislike for Breed and El Gato. The bunkhouse was almost half a mile beyond El Gato's cabin. Long and low, it was built of logs, with a shake roof. At each end was a chimney and a heavy oak door. At intervals below the eaves were cutouts for rifle barrels, a last line of defense against Indian attacks. Smoke curled from one of the chimneys. To the left of the bunkhouse was a corral, and Nathan counted 15 horses.
Unsaddle your horse and unload the pack horse.
Nathan did so, and Breed led the animals to the corral and turned them loose with the rest of the stock. For the lack of anything better to do, Nathan shouldered his saddle and started toward the bunkhouse. He was puzzled. El Gato was treating him as though he were a prisoner, yet he had been allowed to keep his weapons. Nathan could only play along until he learned what they had in store for him. He stepped into the bunkhouse unannounced, and within a split second, every man had his hand on the butt of his Colt. There was no light except that from the open door and the fire that blazed in the fireplace. Nathan counted 11 men when he was finally able to see into the gloom. While there were many bunks, everybody had congregated in one end of the bunkhouse, probably so they only had to feed one fire. Most of the men simply reclined on their bunks, some of them smoking Quirlies. The bunks were two-tiered along both walls. Each consisted of a heavy cedar frame with latticed strips of cowhide as wide as a man's hand. Nathan chose a lower bunk, leaving his saddle on it while he went out for the pack saddle. He found Bree lifting the edge of the canvas that covered his pack. Nathan paused, saying nothing, his thumbs hooked in his pistol belt. Bree stood up, his eyes lighted with anticipation. But Nathan didn't follow through, and Bree backed away. Near the corral, Nathan saw Cotton Blossom. As long as he remained at Cocodrilo Rancho, he would have to feed the dog outside. Cotton Blossom, Nathan thought wryly, used better judgment in choosing his companions than did Nathan himself. When Nathan entered the bunkhouse with the pack saddle, he found the bunk he had chosen had already been claimed by another, and his saddle lay on the rough floor.
Gents, I aim to have one of these bunks. If any man of you wants a different one, he'd best claim it now. The next one I choose, I aim to keep.
Nobody said anything, and he chose yet another lower bunk. A big man got up off the lower bunk next to the one Nathan had taken. He was 2 or 3 inches taller than Nathan, outweighed him by 30 pounds, and his doubled fists looked as big as hams.
My name's Yoakum, and when I turned in, I piled my boots and hat on that bunk. I reckon you'll find it a mite crowded.
I don't think so. Your hat and boots won't be there.
Nathan backed away from Yoakum's first punch and threw one of his own. His right hand connected with Yoakum's chin, and it was like slugging an oak. Nathan was more agile than his opponent, but when Nathan stumbled over his saddle, he fell back against the frame of an upper bunk, and Yoakum took advantage. Yoakum wrapped his big arms around Nathan and began to squeeze. Nathan drove his right knee into Yoakum's groin. Yoakum's next move took Nathan completely by surprise. The big man just threw himself at Nathan like a pouncing cougar. Nathan's head struck the heavy cedar frame of a lower bunk, and it was a struggle to remain conscious. Yoakum had caught his left leg and was trying to keep him from getting away. Nathan was able to push himself backward. Nathan drove his right foot out as hard as he could. The boot heel slammed into Yoakum's chin. Nathan got to his feet. Finally, he sat down on the lower bunk he had chosen. Yoakum sat up, wiping his still bleeding nose on his shirt sleeve.
I reckon I'll just leave my boots and hat on the floor under my bunk.
While Nathan didn't have to prove himself again, he still was an outsider. After the fight, Yoakum spoke pleasantly to him, as did Calpana, a Spaniard. The others, Breed, Kirkham, Venado, Tarno, Wolf, York, Peyton, Fortner, and Hickman, remained distant. When Nathan had been there 2 weeks, he began to understand his position. El Gato rode out early one morning, taking all the men with him except Nathan, Breed, and Kirkham. Neither of the pair remaining with Nathan talked to him, and he began to have a better understanding of his status. El Gato and these other men made up one of the renegade bands holed up in Indian Territory. Nathan had been allowed to keep his weapons because he was suspected of being an outlaw. In time, he would be expected to prove himself worthy of becoming a member of the renegade bunch. If he failed to measure up, then his death would be swift and sure. The second day El Gato and the bunch were absent, Nathan managed to get away from the bunkhouse and the watchful eyes of Breed and Kirkham. As long as he didn't go near the corral where the horses were, his watchful companion seemed unconcerned with him. The first time he and Cotton Blossom walked to the spring, Breed followed, seeming satisfied when they drank from the runoff. In the afternoon, Nathan and Cotton Blossom again went to the spring, and this time they weren't followed. El Gato's cabin stood between the bunkhouse and the spring, and it was Nathan's hope that he might again see the young girl he had seen briefly his first day there. But not until the third day of El Gato's absence did he see her again. She stood in the door, looking at him. But when he lifted his hand in greeting, she quickly closed the door. Before he saw her again, before he could talk to her, El Gato and his men returned. They had been gone 6 days, and at least by their standards, the raid had been successful. They drove before them 9 horses, 3 of them with heavy packs. Some of the men had burlap sacks behind their saddles. Nathan was expecting some ultimatum from El Gato, and he wondered how long he must wait for a confrontation. He got his answer to that the second day following the return of the Renegades, when the outlaw leader sent Breed to fetch him. This time, Nathan was ushered into the small cabin. El Gato sat in a big rocking chair, with his boots off and without the bandolier of shells draped over his shoulder. He nodded to a straight-backed chair, and Nathan sat down. He allowed his eyes to roam around the room. There was very little furniture. Instead, there were two saddles, most of a 100-pound sack of grain, bridles, and various other horse gear. Other items seemed so out of place, Nathan felt certain they had been stolen. The door to the next room wasn't a door at all, but a blanket hung over the opening.
Senor Silver, for the next week, during daylight hours, you will take your turn as sentry duty. 3 days from today, we have some business to attend to. You shall ride with the others, and we shall see whether you are worthy of becoming one of us.
Nathan said nothing. While he had no intention of becoming a member of El Gato's band of thieves and killers, any objection at this time would only assure him of a fatal dose of lead poisoning. He must devise some means of escape, and it wasn't going to be easy. Nathan began his sentry duty, stationing himself behind an upthrust of stone half a mile beyond the spring. When he became drowsy and boredom overtook him, he walked back to the spring for a drink. The weather was unseasonably warm for December. Cotton Blossom spent most of the first day with him on sentry duty and then took to roaming the woods. None of the outlaws bothered Nathan, for his saddle was in the bunkhouse and both his horses in the corral. One afternoon after he'd become particularly weary of sentry duty, he started back to the spring for water. While Cotton Blossom had begun the day with him, the dog had quickly satisfied his own boredom by wandering away.
There's a nice dog. Hey, you're a good boy, aren't you? Good boy.
Nathan crept closer and found the girl from El Gato's cabin carrying on a one-sided conversation with Cotton Blossom. Her arms were around the dog, and he sat there patiently as though aware of her distress. At Nathan's approach, the girl sprang to her feet.
That's my dog, ma'am, and I won't hurt you. Please, stay and talk.
If I'm caught, he'll beat me, and he'll kill you.
Well, then we'll both have to take some risk. Who are you, and why are you here in Indian Territory with outlaws?
I'm Mary Holden, and I'm here because they brought me here. They burned our place in Kansas and shot my ma and pa.
How old are you, Mary, and how long have you been here?
I just turned 17. And I've been here almost a year. Are you one of them?
No, and I'm counting on you to keep my secret. Somehow I aim to escape, and I'll take you with me. Will you trust me?
Oh, God, yes. When?
I don't know. They're riding out again in a few days, and I have to ride with them. I may have to wait until we're far from here, free myself of them, and ride back for you. Have you been harmed in any way?
No, but the pig makes me take off my clothes, and he just looks at me. He tells the others he will take me to Mexico and sell me.
I'll put that out of your mind, because it's not going to be that way. I can't come looking for you, so you have to find me. I can get to the spring without being followed. Watch for me. I'll be here at least 2 or 3 days before I ride out with him. Does he always leave men here when they ride out?
Yes, at least 2. He wouldn't dare leave me alone.
I can handle 2 of them, but not the whole pack. Just remember, next time they ride out, I'll be going with them. But I'll be back for you. I don't know just when, because it'll depend on how soon I'm able to break away. Just don't say or do anything to arouse suspicion.
Oh, I won't. I don't talk to him, and he won't let the others come near me. I'd best be going back.
With a final tug on Cotton Blossom's ears, she started back. Nathan felt his temper rising. While he might rescue Mary Holden, how long would it take El Gato to replace her with another unfortunate girl? Indian Territory, January 24th, 1871. 3 more times Nathan was able to speak to Mary Holden, the 3rd time being the day before El Gato's band was to ride out. That same afternoon, Elgato sent for Nathan, and this time he came immediately to the point.
We are withdrawing some money from the bank at Wichita. I will take 3 men into the bank with me. You will be one of the 3. We ride in the morning at dawn.
When they rode out, only Breed and Kirkham were left behind. Every man carried enough rations in his saddlebags for 4 days. Nathan had brought enough jerked beef to share with Cotton Blossom. While the dog disliked all the outlaws, he would follow Nathan, probably at some distance. The weather had turned bitter cold right after the first of the year, and there had been a continual threat of snow. Nathan wanted it, needed it, if he were to escape from the outlaws. He must break away and return to Cocodrilo Rancho before Elgato discovered what he had in mind. His pack saddle and pack horse were still there, of course, but so were Breed and Kirkham. The big unanswerable question was whether or not Elgato would delay his raid in Wichita to pursue Nathan Stone. The nearer they were to Wichita when Nathan broke loose, the greater a possibility the renegades would let Nathan go and continue without him, or so Nathan hoped. Come dawn of their second day on the trail, the snow started. At first, it was fine, mixed with sleet that rattled off their hat brims and stung their faces as it was whipped on a rising wind. Finally, the snow took on all the proportions of a blizzard, making it difficult for a rider to see the man and horse ahead of him. Eventually, Elgato led them to the lee side of a ridge, clothed in a thick stand of pines. It was all the shelter they were likely to find. Already, the snow was deep enough to supply them with water. There was no sun, but a quick look at his watch told Nathan they were less than 2 hours away from nightfall. There were many fallen pines, some resinous, so the outlaws built a roaring fire. Elgato seemed especially pleased. They weren't far south of Wichita, and it might well snow all night. What better time to rob the bank than during a blinding snowstorm? There was hot coffee, and the ridge offered some protection from the howling wind. Nathan found Cotton Blossom near the picketed horses and fed the dog some jerked beef.
Yokum, Venado, and Hickman, you will stay awake and feed the fire until midnight. Fortner, Peyton, and York, you will take over at midnight and feed the fire until dawn.
It was the sensible thing to do, for when the wind howled across the plains and the snow lay deep, even marauding Indians sought shelter. Most of the renegades spread their blankets as near the roaring fire as possible, and Nathan allowed them to take all the available space. It suited his purpose to remain on the outer fringes, for he intended to ride away at the first opportunity. There was a possibility, with Yoakum, Venado, and Hickman well away from the fire gathering more wood, that Nathan might reach his horse unseen. Once in the saddle, he could give the black its head, for the horse had been at Cocodrilo Ranch long enough to consider the corral home. There was even a chance, Nathan thought, that he might escape and not be missed until the next morning. The snow continued, and there being nothing else to do, the outlaws had rolled in their blankets. Nathan followed their example, waiting for the trio of fire tenders to drag in more dead pines. As soon as they were so engaged, he quickly rolled his blankets and made his way to where the horses were tied. His hands were numb with cold before he managed to get the black saddled. He led the animal for half a mile before climbing into the saddle. Cotton Blossom was a dark shadow against the white of the snow, loping along beside him. He gave the black its head, bowing his own, for the wind still whipped the snow in from the west. That and the intuition of the faithful black horse was all that told him he was riding south. He rode on, not knowing where he was or how far he had ridden, but time stood still. Somewhere a pine limb snapped under its burden of snow. The forest through which he rode assured him he was back in Indian territory and offered some welcome protection from wind and snow. Despite the bone-chilling cold and the deepening snow, he was compelled to stop at intervals and rest the black. He walked about, stomping his feet in a vain attempt to restore some feeling. He removed his gloves, thrusting his hands into his pockets. He was tempted to find a place to hole up for the night, but without a fire, he could freeze to death in his sleep. Besides, Elgato and the renegades might be pursuing him. The old varmint just might be vindictive enough to mount a search for him, snowstorm or not. So he rode on. When the dawn came, it was almost unnoticeable, for the sky lightened only a little. Reaching the stream, Nathan reined up. Here. After the black had rested, Nathan took a sack of rye from behind his saddle and poured his hat a third full. He held the hat while the black horse hungrily devoured the contents. He then watered the animal, shared what was left of the jerked beef with Cotton Blossom, and rode on. Try as he might, Nathan was unable to recognize any landmarks, for the snow had changed everything. He realized they had reached Cocodrilo Rancho only when he reached the spring, a few hundred yards south of Elgato's cabin. From there, he led the black. He would leave the horse at the cabin and proceed on foot to the bunkhouse. By the time he reached the cabin, the girl had the door open.
You came back. You came back for me.
Yes, but I'll have to silence the 2 men at the bunkhouse. If you have any coffee, put some on to boil. I'll be back.
Nathan started for the bunkhouse, thankful it had no windows. He would be discovered only if Breed or Kirkham opened the door before he was able to get the drop. He had no intention of killing them unless they forced him to. In the pocket of his sheepskin coat was rope that he had brought for the occasion. He drew his right-hand Colt, cocked it, and slammed open the bunkhouse door. Breed and Kirkham sat up on their bunks, grabbing frantically for their weapons. The shot had the desired effect. They froze.
Belly down on the floor. I only want what's mine, and I reckon you gents won't interfere if you're tied good and tight.
Damn you. We'll freeze.
Well, that's a chance you have to take. Unless you'd prefer I just shoot you.
Given the alternative, they sprawled face down on the floor. Nathan had only begun to tie Kirkham's hands behind his back when Breed made his play. He rolled over and got no farther. Breed lay still. Nathan gave his attention to Kirkham.
Get up. Stretch out on your bunk. I'll give you a break.
Kirkham did so, and Nathan lashed each of his ankles to the foot of the bunk and each of his wrists to the head. He then dumped Breed on his bunk and lashed him down as he had Kirkham. It was more consideration than they deserved, but they might be many hours away from discovery, and he was leaving them in positions not all that torturous. He took their colts and flung them far out into the snow. He then shouldered the pack saddle and stepped out the door. Cotton Blossom was already near the corral, and Nathan quickly caught up and loaded the pack horse. He led the animal back to the cabin where Mary Holden waited. She let him in, and he smelled the coffee.
Oh, I heard a shot, and I was afraid that you'd
Nobody's
been hurt.
Nobody's hurt. Not much, anyway. Breed and Kirkham are tied to their bunks. They'll be a mite stiff, but they'll get over it. Can you ride?
Yes, but not like this. I'll
take one of these saddles and saddle you a horse. But you can't travel the way you are until we can do better. Can't you wear some of Elgato's duds? Take a warm shirt, Levi's, and a coat. Find a pair of boots, shoes, something to protect your feet, even if they're too large. I can get you something decent once we're away from here, but it's almighty cold out there.
I'll try to find something. Oh, the coffee's ready.
Nathan found a tin cup and drank most of the coffee. By then, Mary had returned with an assortment of things, including a pair of boots.
You can change out here by the fire. I'll go to the corral and catch you a horse. Which of these saddles do you prefer?
The one nearest the door. That's mine. Oh, they took my horse, too. He's dark gray. A Gruya.
Nathan took the saddle and headed for the corral. There were 3 more horses, one of them a Gruya, and Nathan caught him without difficulty. He led the horse back to the cabin. He almost laughed, for Mary looked like a scarecrow. The sleeves of the blue flannel shirt came well over her hands, and the legs of the Levi's were a foot too long. They were far too large in the waist, too, for when she bent down to roll up the legs, the Levi's slid down around her ankles.
Damn, I can't do it.
You'll have to, until we can do better. He must have an extra belt somewhere.
Nathan managed to find one, and with his knife cut some extra holes. The boots were too large, but with 3 pairs of socks, she made them fit. Then, wearing a coat that swallowed her small frame, they went outside. Nathan hoisted her into the saddle. They rode southeast, the snow covering the tracks of the horses. Thank you.